Counsel for Appellant, you may begin. I'll just remind both of you, I know you're both familiar with our way, so you each have 15 minutes for your main argument. You'll have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal, Counsel for Appellant. And if you, there's a switch, you can raise or lower the podium if you like. So whenever you're ready.
Thank you and good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Eriksson, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Abraham Dolo. Mr. Dolo is requesting that this court reverse his criminal sexual conduct conviction and remand for a new trial based on the trial court's erroneous evidentiary ruling related to his statement to law enforcement and whether the entirety of that statement should have been introduced to the jury. The rule of completeness within Rule 106 of the Rules of Evidence is based on the principles of fairness that our adversarial system require. And it is fundamentally unfair for the state, as it did in this case, to introduce a portion of Mr. Dolo's statements for the sole purpose of establishing that he was lying and that he had a consciousness of guilt without the jury being able to consider the remainder of the statement, which supported his theory of innocence within his statements to law enforcement. Also, what took place in this case illustrates what can happen if a trial court does not abide by this rule. As the record reflects, the prosecutor focused almost his entire cross-examination of Mr. Dolo on statements that Mr. Dolo did make or did not make in the remainder of the statement that the jury was never able to consider.
So I want to ask about, at the time the district court was deciding what to let in, that cross-examination had not happened. Okay, let's assume for a moment that the state hadn't asked to introduce any portion of that record. Okay, so would we agree that 106 now is irrelevant to the case or to the appeal, right? So if no portion of it came in by the state, then you get to cross-examination. At that point, do you think you should be entitled, is the interview transcript admissible at that point based on the cross-examination that you're complaining of?
Well, so the rule would not apply at that point.
Exactly.
And it would be the defendant's case in chief. I don't think anybody would be able to introduce the statement at that point. The prosecutor could certainly reference portions of it and say, did you say this or did you not say this? But at that point, the jury had no idea that there was an interview. In that hypothetical, the jury would never have seen any portion of the interview.
Right. My question, I guess, is what it seems to me is at the point, and this is what I want you to respond to, at the point the district court is making a decision whether to admit the whole on the state's request to admit some, all the district court has, all that's developed at this point is let's look at that portion, that excerpt, and decide whether that excerpt on its face requires, in fairness, the remainder to come in to contextualize that excerpt. Okay, the district court made a decision that the rest of it was not necessary to contextualize that excerpt, which was meant to show a consciousness of guilt because it was a lie about the, they argue about the sleeping arrangements, right?
Yep.
Now, the case develops, right? And there's witness testimony and there's cross-examination and so on. And at that point, I understand maybe the defendant's counsel wants to introduce the rest of the statement. In fact, early on, defense counsel said the rest of it's going to come in. The state says, no, wait a minute, it's not. And it's like, okay, well, we'll get there when we get there. But I don't see that the defense asked to introduce the rest of it then. And it seems to me trying to retrofit the rest of the evidentiary issues into that initial 106 decision instead of looking at what predicates there might be for prior inconsistent statements or whatever that have developed during the course of the rest of the testimony.
I'll try to answer that. So at the point when the error took place was when the court ruled that the remainder could not come in.
Right, so which is meant to be introduced at that time contemporaneously with it to contextualize it. So we need to look at that time.
That's correct.
Okay.
And the purpose that the prosecutor stated was to establish a consciousness of guilt.
Right.
And the remainder of the statement, in fairness, would support Mr. Dolo's position that he was telling the truth and that those statements that he made during the interrogation supported his defense at trial. So in fairness to Mr. Dolo, just having an excerpt of that played to the jury and not the whole thing at that time, that's the error. And the plain language of the rule requires it at that time that it should have been introduced. Our argument is not that it should have come in during Mr. Dolo's case in chief or that he should have had the ability to bring it up during his cross-examination. The error took place in that evidentiary ruling when Detective Brown testified. So at that point, that's when the entire interview should have
come in. So irrespective of whether any cross-examination later occurred, you're saying at that time it needed to come in.
That's correct.
And so the rest of the cross-examination, et cetera, isn't really relevant to analyzing whether it should have come in at the time the decision was made?
That goes more towards the harm, but also supports our position of what the purpose of the rule is and what can happen as a result. It's a great illustration of what can happen when only a portion of a recorded statement is introduced at trial, and then it's referred to numerous times later on. That opened the door at that point for the prosecutor to do what he did, because there was only a portion that was played to the jury.
And then later, was there, at the opening the door issue, then you're saying, you know, it opened the door to that later cross-examination. At that point, was there any effort by the defendant to say, you've opened the door to admit what was previously not admissible under 106, but now you've opened the door by talking about it and asked the district court to make a decision at that time to admit it because of an opening the door?
No, and when I use the term open the door, I don't mean it in that context.
Okay.
What I'm saying is the ruling by the court then allowed the prosecutor to do what he did. And because there was only a portion of it, there was no, the trial court at that point didn't say, all right, prosecutor, now you can't reference any other part of the interview. So he was able to do that. And no, there wasn't a second objection at the time of the cross-examination. The error had already taken place. There was a valid objection that preserved the issue at that time. So there was no purpose of having a second objection and a request for it to come in during his case in chief.
So, Mr. Erickson, if I can turn to another issue. I think you pointed out in your brief that in the conclusion of law by the district court in the post-conviction order, I'm not sure if it's labeled conclusion. Mixes those things up a bit, perhaps. The court says, although the entire recorded interview was not introduced, petitioner had the opportunity to cross-examine Detective Brown about the interview. I mean, I think you share the perspective. I understand it that is not, you know, fully supported by the record. Is that enough? Is that mistake? Assuming that is a mistake, is that enough for us to send this back to the district court without reaching perhaps the Rule 106? Is an abuse of discretion?
Absolutely. I mean,
I think
there are numerous abuses of discretion within that order, and I think that is absolutely one of them. If you look at the record, every time Mr. Dole's attorney tried to talk to or question Detective Brown about what the other portions of the statement were, the state objected and the court sustained those objections. So there was never any opportunity to thoroughly cross-examine regarding the rest of the statement.
And so, have you briefed that?
What was that?
Have you briefed the error in that? What is the error? What is the evidentiary error that the district court made in limiting the testimony?
Well,
that's different from isn't that different from a 106 question?
I mean, I think it's a cumulative how it affected the verdict in this case. I mean, the fact that he was not able to cross-examine him, whether or not that was a separate error or not, it shows that this was unfair to Mr. Dolo because he couldn't introduce the whole statement. If he was able to introduce the whole statement when he was supposed to during the state's case in chief, this would never have mattered. So the fact that those objections took place and he was not able to cross-examine, that's not a separate error that we are alleging, but I do think it supports our argument that out of fairness, the whole statement should have come in.
One other question, Mr. Erickson. The state and the district court talk about the Bauer decision. I went back and looked at that decision where, as you point out, the state didn't actually introduce any part of the actual recording, but the Bauer decision relies upon Mills. And I found that case harder to read exactly what was happening, and I just wanted to get your impression. And counsel for respondents, I'll ask you to address this as well. So was it also your read of that case that the same thing happened as in Bowers? The state didn't actually introduce any part of the actual recording. It wasn't simply a matter of officer, you know, someone testifying about what the defendant said. I just want to make sure.
That's
that
absolutely correct. And in Mills, just like in Bauer, the statement was never introduced, and the argument on appeal was you should have introduced parts of it. The defense argued that you should have introduced parts of it or the whole thing, but it was never introduced by the state in either of the case. So if you look at the progression of that, if the state doesn't introduce any part of it, then Rule 106 doesn't apply. And there's no requirement to introduce it at the time during the state's case in chief. And then as a result, when the defense asks for it, then it is inadmissible hearsay because it's not offered by a party opponent at that time. So if you look at the progression of that, that's why it was inadmissible in those two cases. And I know it's not clear in Mills, but if you look at one of the footnote states that the statement was never offered by the state at any point.
And if you look at neither party cited this case, I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, and counsel for the state can certainly correct me at the proper opportunity, but the Supreme Court issued a decision in September of 2016, State v. Robertson, yep. In which the, it's found at 884-864, the holding was that the trial court acted within its discretion in denying the defendant's request that the entirety of a recorded interview with police be admitted into evidence. In that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court specifically pointed out that in Robertson, the 2016 case, as in Bauer and as in Mills, no portion of the recording was ever introduced by the state, and therefore Rule 106 didn't apply, obviously recognizing that had a portion of the recorded interview been introduced, Rule 106 at least would have been in play.
I completely agree, and I have reviewed that case, and I think the Supreme Court's been very consistent that when any portion of a statement is introduced, the remainder should be introduced. I have not found a case
without further analysis under Rule 106?
Well, I think there is a fairness analysis, okay. And I think, you know, as there are a couple federal cases that I haven't cited in my brief and some treatises that have talked about it, that you can't introduce inadmissible evidence through it, right? So if the full statement included a criminal history or some prior bad act or a reference to a lie detector test or something like that, then you would have to sanitize what else comes in because that is clearly inadmissible. But in this case, there was nothing inadmissible about the remaining portions of the statement.
Okay, you referred to both a fairness analysis and then kind of an exception that, well, you can't use it to introduce inadmissible evidence. You need to sanitize it. I'm just want to be clear. So you're not saying, okay, it absolutely always has to come in. But what's the difference between, I mean, a fairness analysis, that seems pretty amorphous, as opposed to just saying you can't use it to introduce otherwise inadmissible evidence like a criminal history. Could you just clarify your position
on
that?
Yeah, I agree. I do think the wording of the rule is a little amorphous, as you said. But the fairness, I think it's a situation exactly like this, right, where a portion of a statement comes in and then the state tries to use the remainder of it without the jury consider it. I mean, I think we can all agree that that is unfair to a defendant, and if there is a purpose to the rule, it has to be that, right? There are situations where maybe a portion of a statement is allowed in and it's never referenced again. There's no reference to the jury that there's another part of the statement, or there's no specific reference to any of the, you know, the substance of it. That might happen, and that might be okay. But in this case, when there are clear references to pretty much the entire interrogation and throughout his entire cross-examination.
But do we get to look at that? Isn't it, don't we look at that point in time when the district court's making that decision? I mean, that seemed to be what you were saying earlier about whether or not to admit parts of it or the whole thing.
Yep.
Isn't that when we can what we look at, not what happened later?
Yeah, and again, the state's proposed reason for introducing this that the prosecutor stated when he asked for this to come in was because he wanted to prove that Mr. Dola was lying and that these statements showed a consciousness of guilt. Well, what do the remainder show? Well, Mr. Dola believed that it showed that it supported his contention that he was innocent and that his statements were consistent and that he has been consistent since the first interrogation of him up until trial and then at his defense at trial. And absolutely, I mean, when these are pretrial rulings, we don't know what's going to happen at the trial, but you have to look at the entire statement and say, is this fair? No, it's not fair, and I think the plain language of the rule makes that clear. If I could just, you know, as I've been talking about the harm of how this takes place, and I think there was also...
Well, I guess I want to just focus on this some more, because the remainder of the trial, even if that portion had not been introduced, the same cross, et cetera, could have occurred. Right? I mean, you're talking about the unfairness of being cross-examined on the statement, et cetera, but the transcript's not in evidence. Well, that would have happened. That would have been true even if that portion had not come in. The trial could have looked exactly the same without that portion coming in because the cross-examination was on the 50 minutes that did not come in.
So are you saying if the prosecutor wasn't allowed to bring any of it in?
Yeah, or say they just didn't offer it. They didn't offer the 10 minutes, and the cross-examination continued just as it did on the remaining 50 minutes. It seems to me like you're almost saying that if those 10 minutes had not come in, you know, the remainder of the trial wouldn't have looked like it did. There wouldn't have been this cross-examination that was so damaging about the rest of the testimony. But I don't really see how the 10 minutes coming in actually affects the cross-examination on the remaining 50 minutes. It seems like it would have continued just like that, the trial, even without those 10 minutes, because the cross was on the stuff that wasn't in.
Right, but the jury, I see my time's up,
you
can answer.
You can answer the question.
The jury had seen this portion of the video. They knew this interrogation took place. They knew that the prosecutor knew what was in the remaining portions of it. So by witnessing that 10 minutes or whatever, however long that was, that affected the jury and how they viewed the questions regarding the rest of the questions that were posed to him during cross-examination, because they knew the environment of that interrogation. They knew he had the opportunity to make these statements. And again, some of the questions that were posed were questions that were just not true. Right? They said you...
Which could have been the case even if the 10 minutes didn't come in, right? I mean, and then you just deal with the trial that you're... Or the trial as you're dealing with it in that moment, it seems to me. In which case, the defense needs to say, no, I want to introduce it because it conflicts, whatever.
Right. And I think that's why we have this rule, right? Because it contemplates that exact situation of when the jury sees part of it, they need to see the whole thing. It's from the jury's perspective, right? If the jury knows that there's this interview, has seen portions of it, it needs to see the rest of it to have a full understanding of what took place in that room. I can respond and rebuttal. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. And I'd like to use my argument time to hone in on some of the questions that have already been raised during appellant's argument this morning. I would just like to first clarify that the standard here is an abuse of discretion, whether or not the post-conviction court abused its discretion in denying appellant's petition, post-conviction petition.
You know, in regard to that issue, since that clearly is the correct standard of our review, I did a lot of my own research to try to see if I could find any case in the state of Minnesota in which a portion of a recorded statement that was a question and answer statement by law enforcement had been introduced without the entirety being introduced upon request of either the state or the defendant. And I could not find any case, including one case I looked at, which is State v. Dye, is a 2015 published case of the Minnesota Court of Appeals involving a defendant who wanted to introduce a portion of a videotape, a recorded statement, and the district court cautioned the defendant that if he did that, without citing Rule 106, he would be opening the door to introduction of the entire statement. And in fact, then it was, the entire statement was introduced. But back to my question, are you aware of any state court case in which a portion of a videotaped question-answer interview was introduced with a request by the other side that the entire videotape be shown to the jury and that request was denied?
Your Honor, I too did quite a bit of research on that issue as well, and I would have to look back.
Well, you would have cited it for us, wouldn't you?
I would have been more clear in my factual parentheticals in my brief if I did find one, and I that would be quite factually similar to this case today. I do cite three particular cases. One is a U.S. case from the 11th
Circuit.
What kind
of a U.S. case?
It's 11th Circuit. And that is the Paquette case. I also cite Kewell, a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1928.
I have that case here.
And Olschlegel, another
I have that case. I don't know. How does that help you, either of those old Supreme Court cases?
And, Your Honor, my apologies to the court. I do have to clarify something written on page 11 of my brief. In my parenthetical regarding Olschlegel, it appears that I discuss it as a prior police interview. That's incorrect. It was a prior informal interview between attorneys of a defendant on trial at that time and then attorneys for a future co-defendant, and those attorneys got together to discuss that future co-defendant's version of the facts, essentially.
And that was the case, wasn't it, where the guy went to the police department himself to make a statement?
Your Honor, the Olschlegel case is the case about the stolen butter.
Yeah.
And it's my understanding that the statement, of which there was a transcript, was just an informal statement that occurred somewhere other than a police department, just between two counsels.
Oh, this is the case where the county attorney used part of a transcript of a statement. So, and then the request was that the entire transcript be introduced.
That's right.
But we have a number of more recent cases in which part of a written statement is used as the basis to ask somebody questions without the court requiring that the entire statement be introduced. Because the actual statement wasn't introduced by the first party. But here we have a videotape interview. And I've seen them. They're just like, in many ways, having somebody on the witness stand. I mean, the jury judges people in a videotape, just as it is asked to judge people on the witness stand based upon all the bases for credibility. So that's what we have here, is that it wasn't just questioning based on statements made in the videotape. The state asked that a portion of the videotape be shown to the jury.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the district court made note that, this gets to Judge Justin's point as well, the district court made note that the state only wanted to introduce a portion of the video regarding the sleeping arrangements in the home. And at that time, when the district court reviewed the entire Scales tape, nothing from the unplayed portion regarded the played portion, such that if the jury heard just the played portion, they would be confused, or that portion mischaracterizes some sort of statements in
there. Isn't that classic cherry picking?
Well, Your Honor, that's exactly what the Rule 106 analysis is. And the case law supports that as well, where a jury may be factually misled unless the unplayed portions come in. Then you don't need the rest of the video. Let's analyze
that on those terms. I mean, the portion that came in was the sleeping arrangements for the purpose of showing consciousness of guilt, right? That was what I think I saw the rationale given by the prosecutor in the transcript. So it wants to show that the defendant was aware of his guilt, and that's why he said what he said, okay? The remaining part of the transcript, his denials, aren't those also evidence of his view of his own guilt? I mean, couldn't that come in to contextualize, just even let's leave aside the rest of the cross and all of that, but just to contextualize, you want to say here what he said here shows shows he's conscious of guilt. Well, don't his denials also reflect on the question of whether he's conscious of his guilt? They explicitly say no.
And, Your Honor, I do see what you're saying, but the Rule 106 case law does not regard that type of nuance in analyzing whether a whole or a portion of the statement can come in. Instead, what the case law discusses is if the jury is going to be factually misled about admissions or something factually relevant to the elements of the crime, and that's not what is occurring here with regard to a credibility.
When you talk about case law, tell us what case you're talking about, because, you know, I just see Bauer and Mills and, you know, it's being really different because the state didn't introduce any part of the recording. So you're talking about 106 case law. What's the case that stands for just what you said?
And, Your Honor, I am piecing together certain parts, but, for example, in the Paquette case, that's the 11th Circuit case.
Is there any Minnesota, I'm sorry, I did look at that case. Is there any Minnesota case that would stand for the proposition of what you just said?
And I'm only using that case since it's the easiest to explain. But for example, in the Kuehl case, the 1928 case, the defendant was accused of embezzlement. And the jury heard evidence in some recorded statement that that defendant had settled a civil case, leaving the impression that the defendant had made some admission. And that was not factually correct.
Wait a second. Isn't the holding in the Kuehl case, looking at the syllabus of the court, that when the inculpatory part of a transaction is proven as an admission, the defendant has the right to prove the exculpatory part of the same transaction?
I don't have the syllabus in front of me, Your Honor, so I apologize. Okay. But that case, he was allowed to bring in the entire statement.
Wasn't that dealing with the civil correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't have the case in front of me either. Wasn't that a civil case? And shouldn't we have a higher standard, a different standard when it comes to criminal?
Your Honor, I believe that was a criminal case, the issue was whether or not something happened in the civil case that misled the jury. And so in those particular cases, it is true that the fairness analysis says if a jury is going to be misled, then the entire statement should come in. And that is not the case of, that's not the facts that we have here.
Well, misled according to whom?
Well, the district court looked at the entire statement and made that analysis. And if I could just point something out, Your Honors, under Minnesota case law, it appears that what's missing in this conversation right now regards self-serving hearsay, and I suspect I'm going to get some questions on that.
Finish your sentence. I didn't mean to interrupt.
So Bauer, it seems like this court is uncomfortable that Bauer and other cases indicate that where no part of a statement has come in, then Rule 106 doesn't apply. But Bauer also has some additional holdings as well regarding self-serving hearsay. And upon that rule, the district court did rely in excluding the rest of the statements as well. And that's also important to analyze here because those statements were self-serving hearsay.
Well, they were denials. They were denials of guilt. I mean, you have a defendant who's being questioned by law enforcement. He's answering the questions. Well, I mean, what if those answers are the truth?
And, Your Honor, all of that information came out through direct examination of that detective.
Well, some of the questions asked of the detective were sustained on the basis of hearsay. After the court let in the portion of the video in which the questioning and the answers, why wasn't that hearsay?
Well, I do see what Your Honor is saying, but on direct examination with the prosecutor asking questions of the detective, that information did come in, that the defendant in this case did vehemently deny the allegations.
But the jury didn't get to see the videotape. The jury just got to see the videotape of the part that the state liked.
And, Your Honor, I do see your point. However, notwithstanding the Rule 106 analysis with the fairness, the rule against self-serving hearsay also kept the statements out as well.
If I could ask you a question about that. When I looked at this, and I'm sure you've looked at this more than I have, but I thought self-serving hearsay usually was a defendant's attempt to introduce, you know, their own out-of-court statements to serve their own interest. And here, isn't that different than here where we're having the state is trying to, and did, introduce this parts of this video. That it just seems to me to not fit. Could you help me with that?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the difference is the policies behind Rule 106 and the rule against self-serving hearsay. If the court did let the entire video statement in, then under the rule against self-serving hearsay, it allows that defendant to testify, essentially, which is what Judge Shellhouse was getting at, without having to actually be on the stand and be subject to cross-examination. So I do agree that there is some tension between the rules, but if you look at the time the district court was making its decision with regard to the 106 analysis, it did not let those statements come in, both because there is no fairness argument and because the prohibition against self-serving hearsay requires that if a defendant wants to present his side of the story, then that comes out through cross-examination or the defendant testifying himself. And as this court has pointed out, cross-examination, there was an opportunity for cross-examination, even if it was limited by the district court. And so when you look at the fairness analysis, when you look at the rule against self-serving hearsay, that leads you to the rule, the standard of whether any error, if it did occur, was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, so let me ask you something. Am I mistaken? Didn't the appellant in this case testify?
That is correct.
So he did testify. And I just have to say that the first time we hear the Minnesota Supreme Court talk about self-serving hearsay seems to me to be in 1977 in State v. Taylor, a case in which the Supreme Court affirmed the denial of the introduction of a defendant's oral out-of-court statements. But in that case, the defendant, immediately after, I can't recall if it's a murder or a shooting, I don't know if it was a murder, he went straight to his friend's house and made all sorts of comments about what had happened and what hadn't happened. And then he went to the police department voluntarily and gave a statement and repeated those statements. And then later he gave a statement to the police and repeated those statements. And the court called them self-serving hearsay statements because they were obviously the court believed, and it was argued, that this was just his side of the story, that he immediately tried to create the narrative and memorialize it. And I grant you that we see in some subsequent cases this referral to self-serving hearsay, but I think absent a situation where you have a defendant making a voluntary statement, it's hard for me to understand that concept. But do you have anything you'd like to add?
Your Honor, may I clarify? Is it your view of the record that appellant's statements to Detective Brown were involuntary? He was out of custody at the time and invited in.
No, but I mean, it isn't a situation where he decided to go to the police station and make a statement without being requested to do so.
And Your Honor,
you can go ahead and answer the question. I have one quick one as well.
I see that I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors. I don't see a difference between the voluntariness of someone entering the police department and someone saying, yes, I'll speak to an officer who is requesting in this particular set of facts. This defendant was out of custody, wasn't taken into custody afterwards, and participated in the interview for a lengthy period of time. And so, Your Honor, if I could just make one more point about that. The unplayed portion of the interview is this defendant's side of the story, which rightfully could not have come in. And with regard to the harmless error standard, as the judges have pointed out, nothing in the unplayed portion didn't come in at other points during the case.
If I may ask you one just specific question, going to conclusion 8 of the district court's decision post-conviction relief, that last sentence of it, that the petitioner had the opportunity to cross-examine a Detective Brown about the interview. Would you agree with me that that is a misstatement?
Your Honor, I would have to look at the transcript one more time. I don't recall off the top of my head if that is on its face incorrect or not. Okay. My apologies. If the court would prefer I do a letter brief in response to that, I would be happy to.
I think we're fine. Thank you.
My apologies. Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
If I could start with the hearsay issue, whether or not it's self-serving hearsay is irrelevant in this case because it was introduced by the state and Mr. Dolo is a party opponent. So it's a strategic decision by the prosecutor at that point to determine whether or not he wants to introduce part of it, because if he introduced parts of it, then the rest of it comes in.
Well, okay, that would, if there's no Rule 106 analysis, but let's imagine a Rule 106 analysis. I'm trying to think of a scenario where we would come to some common agreement where there's a portion that could come in and the rest wouldn't have to come in under 106. I mean, what if there were an interview where the defendant said, you know, I was at my mom's house at the start of it. That's later proved to be a lie. And then the rest of the interview is filled with denials, et cetera. Could the state introduce that first part of it? I was at my mom's house.
Possibly.
And then would they be forced to introduce the defendant's denials?
I want to be careful with this because I think what really matters is the purpose of why the state is introducing the part.
I agree.
And if the state is introducing, let's say this bedroom thing was to establish an element, and there was nothing else in the statement regarding the bedrooms, it'd be a different situation. But the whole purpose of the state introducing this is to establish a consciousness of guilt,
I get
and that,
that
Mr. Dole lied.
I want to deal with the hearsay part of it. I mean, obviously, the defendant, there is a hearsay problem if the defendant tried to introduce his prior denials, right?
Absolutely.
We got a hearsay problem.
We wouldn't be arguing that.
Yeah. So the question is whether the defendant can force the state to introduce what would be hearsay if he tried to introduce it, because the state is introducing a portion of his statements. And there could be a situation, I think you would agree, where a portion of the statements to prove something else, like you're focusing on the consciousness, but I'm trying to give an example where they're trying to prove something else, you know, like the falseness of an alibi, or just, I don't know, where he lives, something even that's like, you know, it doesn't have the same, its purpose is different. You couldn't force the state to put in what the defendant could not put in himself.
Are you talking about hearsay?
Right.
I believe the language of the rule is unique. It says the defendant may require the state to introduce the
evidence.
Exactly.
And you think any portion introduced, irrespective of purpose, forces the state to introduce what the defendant could not otherwise introduce?
As far as hearsay goes, absolutely. Because it's still the state introducing the entirety of the statement. You have to kind of take a step back and say, all right, what would the state do in this case? It would press play on the recording and it would be introduced. At that point, they are the one introducing it, and it falls under the exception of a statement by a party opponent.
Doesn't that swallow Rule 106 entirely? If the state introduces any statement, it all comes in.
Well, I thought you were asking about hearsay versus when I'm talking.
It's forcing the state to put in. I mean, I think that's the, you know, when we're looking at the purposes, when we look at Bauer and the self-servingness of the statements, the defendant doesn't get to put in his prior self-serving statements himself. And the question is whether 106 forces the state to do what the defendant could not do to serve the purposes of the...
Yeah, I think it's a strategic decision by the prosecutor, right? The prosecutor has to say, all right, do I want this portion of the statement in it? Is it that important to me? If it is, then the rest of it comes in under a fairness analysis. I think the hearsay analysis and the fairness analysis are two separate things, right? So under the hearsay, I believe that it would always come in as a statement against a party opponent. But
could still be excluded if fairness doesn't
still
require
be excluded,
it.
Like I was saying before, the difference between what the purpose is. So if it was to prove an element of the offense and not just that he lied and that it was consciousness of guilt, there may be an argument to say, look, there was nothing else in that statement regarding where the bedrooms were. If that was an element of the offense and not just the purpose of establishing that he lied. And I think your earlier question to me of what is the point, if the jury saw 10 minutes, then why does that matter to the rest of it? Well, I think you answered it in your questions to the prosecutor, that those 10 minutes were supporting the state's theory that he lied. The state relied on that during those questions and in closing argument. The rest of the statement supported his theory that he was innocent and that he was being truthful and that he corroborated their theory of the case and their theory of their defense. So I think the fact that the jury saw those 10 minutes, the jury was then required to see the rest to understand the full picture of whether or not he was credible and whether or not he did have a consciousness of guilt. As far as the cases that the prosecutor referenced, all of those cases deal with situations where there was no portion of the statement introduced at trial. So Rule 106 doesn't apply. The hearsay analysis is different. The defendant's trying to get those statements in, and they can't get them in because it is inadmissible hearsay. So there is not a single case that says that that supports the state's position in this case. If the court doesn't have any other questions, we respectfully request that the court reverse Mr. Dole's convictions and remand for a new trial.
I have one follow-up question. Judge Shillhouse asked Ms. Cornell if she had found any case in Minnesota where the entire, I'm not sure I've got your question right, where the entirety of the recorded statement was not introduced where the defendant asked for it. Do you remember that line of questioning? Are you aware of any case?
No appellate decision where the defendant asked for the entirety of it to come in and it didn't come in. I've never seen a situation where it hasn't come in, so I haven't seen it on appeal either.
Anything else?
No.
Thank you both very much. The matter was very well argued and well briefed. We'll take it under advisement, and an opinion will be issued within 90 days.
Case A 18-1641, State of Minnesota versus Mangum.